I want to talk about some calculation that we've just actually submitted in the last couple of weeks. It's a Santa Barbara preprint, or an ITP preprint. And it's about the lattice gauge theory simulation of QCD in the presence of a chemical potential. So it's actually here are the authors. It's a result of a collaboration between groups in Bielefeld and Swansea, who have we share the same computer architecture. So I was joking with Fritjof today that it really is, we have to find a name for our collaboration. It's a Cymro German collaboration. Cymro is the Welsh word for Welsh. So. Okay. So let me review for you why simulating QCD with a baryon or quark chemical potential is difficult. Of course, this is the phase diagram we're all interested in understanding better. And so far, lattice simulations have been very successful and have quantitative predictive power along the zero chemical potential axis up here. And we saw, well, as well as seeing versions of this diagram many, many times last week, we also saw many, many times the lattice predictions for such quantities as the pressure and the energy density as a function of the temperature as one goes along here. But unfortunately, as soon as one wants to go out and consider a system where there is a preponderance of baryons over antibaryons, in other words, where there's a chemical potential, then the numerical techniques which are so successful exactly on axis run into problems. And this was reviewed for us quite nicely last week by Uwe Wiese. And the basic problem is if you have some kind of background density of a conserved charge, such as baryon number, then it means that the system is no longer time reversal invariant. It doesn't look the same when you change T to minus T. And that's fine. There's no problem with that, except that if one goes Wick rotates into Euclidean space, this same transformation changes the sign of the square root of minus 1. And so what that means is that when you write the action and exponentiate it in the Euclidean formalism, this quantity S is now contains an imaginary component, so it means that the Euclidean functional measure is complex for a system with a chemical potential. So you can see that explicitly, perhaps it's not so obvious. The way this problem shows up in QCD in a theory with quarks is that the functional measure is the determinant of some matrix M, which describes the propagation of the quarks in the background of some gauge field. The determinant will be raised to a power N sub F, the number of fermion flavors. And the effect of taking what this equation is shorthand for is saying that the effect of taking the complex conjugate of the determinant of this matrix is the same as reversing the sign of the chemical potential. So therefore, if the chemical potential is not zero, the determinant is not the same as its complex conjugate. And that's another way of saying that the action or the functional measure is complex. And this gives rise to something called the sign problem in simulation. So Uwe covered this quite once again. I'll just run over it quite quickly. There is a formal solution to doing simulations with a complex action. The point is, the way Euclidean simulations work is essentially by importance sampling. So you want to generate an ensemble of field configurations which are representative of the equilibrium that you want to study. And you do that by using the action or the exponentiated action as a probability measure. Well, clearly that only makes sense if the probability measure is positive definite. So if you're dealing with a probability measure which in general can have a phase or in particular can vary in sign, that doesn't make sense. What you can there is the formal solution is to sort of multiply and divide the measure you want by the measure which is manifestly real. In other words, the determinant of the fermion matrix with zero chemical potential. And so therefore one includes the complex part of the measure here with the observable in these red braces here. You can all, this is called reweighting. So in other words, you could perform the simulation, generate the ensemble that you want to sample using zero chemical potential and include the effects of the chemical potential along with the operator that you want to measure all in the same object. At the same time, you can also change the, if you wish, you can also change the bosonic part of the action, the gluon action here. So one could, in principle, update one particular value of the QCD gluon coupling beta naught, but actually perform the measurements with respect to another value beta. That's a formal solution to the sign problem. Why isn't everybody doing this? And the problem is that the denominator of this expression, the partition function, of course, is the expectation value of 1, but 1 in this 1 together with this reweighting factor. And there are very general arguments to suggest that on large volumes, this factor, which should, of course, be 1, is actually exponentially suppressed.
Is it possible to say the same thing in a physical way, say, that you basically simulate vacuum and wait as a fluctuation, dense matter appears?
That's exactly right.
And you have to wait
forever.
Long,
yeah.
If you want it to appear.
Yeah. That's a very physical way of thinking about it. But the point is, if you want to perform a successful measurement of this expectation value, you have to measure both the numerator and the denominator. And to get with a small statistical error, and the number of configurations that one has to take therefore rises as e to the v. So accumulating sufficient statistics in the thermodynamic limit when v is getting big is becoming exponentially difficult. And this is why nobody has managed to make this program work.
Could I ask with reference to your question, in cases where you don't have, say, two colors or something,
yeah,
where you can, in principle, do simulation,
yes,
and you're still getting things wrong by...
You're getting the physics wrong in that case. If you do two-color QCD, you're not getting a Fermi surface. You're getting an interesting theory, which has a Bose-Einstein condensate, but you're not getting the physics of QCD.
So you're still doing that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Because that, wait, there is misunderstanding. In two-color QCD, the nucleons are bosons, too.
Right.
So that's why you don't get Fermi surface.
Yeah.
But you get anything, there's no sign problem.
There's no sign problem. You simulate it on zero mu without reweighting.
There's no reweighting,
no need for this, but it's a very different theory. It's qualitatively different.
I've got a slide on two-color QCD later on. So. Okay. So what can one do? The situation isn't completely hopeless, as I hope to convince you. And in fact, in the last couple of years, I think people have been trying two different routes to go into the plane, off the temperature axis into the plane. Both of those routes have their starting point at or close to the thermal phase transition. So this is why, in principle, you can perhaps do hot QCD with a small chemical potential. So that, roughly speaking, there are two conceptually different things one can do. It turns out that if you stick very, very close, or even try and stay on the phase separation line between the hadronic phase and the plasma phase, then along this line, the equilibrium configurations physically should resemble each other, because they've both got some overlap with hadronic phase and also some with the plasma phase. So therefore, along this line, the reweighting program, which I outlined, that formal formula I wrote on the previous transparency, actually works quite well. It appears to work surprisingly well. In other words, if you go from say here to here, and you reweight simultaneously so that the jump in mu is countered by a corresponding change in temperature, which would correspond to changing the gauge coupling constant beta, then the overlap of between the configurations here and here is sufficiently large that the denominator of the expression I showed you previously is not too badly suppressed. So therefore, there should be a very narrow region all the way along the phase transition line where the reweighting formula can be applied. And that is the program which is being pursued by Fodor and Katz, and many of you will have heard of or seen their results. They actually use this reweighting both in beta and in mu on systems up to 8 cubed by 4, and have actually managed to not only trace out this line, but also have an estimate for the point where it turns from second order into first order in the Kerr limit, and therefore they have furnished the first lattice estimate of the coordinates of the endpoint.
It's a very small lattice.
Yes, yes.
It must be a very non-scale, so even the value of EC must be wrong. So is it corrected somehow, this TC?
They claim that at zero chemical potential, their TC is 170. They also claim that they're using, really, I think, reasonably realistically, massive quarks. The only thing I want to say about the Fodor-Katz calculation, it's clear that this region in which their method is applicable will actually get thinner and thinner as you increase the volume. At the moment, they've only gone up to this volume. They have to calculate that ratio of determinants exactly, which I think is very expensive. And at the moment, my view of their work is that it's just limited by CPU resources. They haven't actually reached the limitations of the method in principle. So yeah.
If somebody came along and said, I've done a mu equals zero calculation of TC on an 8 cubed by 4 lattice, what would the criticisms of that be? I mean, obviously by now, at mu equals zero, people use much, much bigger lattices than
they.
We have more redundancy, right? So how well does it work on such a small lattice at mu equals zero, given what we now know? Yeah, I think when you don't know the value of TC, you estimate something else. I mean, all the observables you look at don't have a really sharp curvature, so it's somehow guesswork where you put the TC. I guess the best is to see in the pure gauge theory that the TC went over the time, went up from 200 to 260 maybe. So it's this sort of 20% error maybe.
So have they used, when they do their, when they start at mu equals zero, have they used the knowledge from better simulations?
Yeah.
I think they went up to 12 cubed by 4 to do a zero chemical potential calibration run, something like that. They did the best they could. The other thing one can do is actually perform the simulations along the zero chemical potential and simply calculate derivatives of quantities that you're interested in, d by d mu, first, second derivatives, and then use knowledge of those derivatives to perform a Taylor expansion into the plane. So this is sort of an analytic continuation method. I mean, in a sense, they're both analytic continuations.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I understand why that red area may be bounded from below, but I don't understand why if I do a very high temperature, the method should get better and better. I don't understand why you draw a curve that goes up.
Like this.
At very high temperature, the effects of mu, you know, and it's looking more and more thermal anyway, so I should be doing better.
What?
I mean, this is a trivial point. From below, it's certainly true.
Well, you're worried about why I've drawn the region like that. I guess I could do my start my analytic continuation here and go as far as I liked. It's starting from here. I can go.
I'm just saying it really does go kind of up like
yeah.
that.
Like that. The new electricity should be smaller. Yeah. Smaller, so it's like this. It's better.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, it is actually an expansion of mu over t, yeah. Formally.
The upper dotted red line should kind of go to the left and then right.
Yeah, it should go like that.
Like
yeah.
The line going from the origin.
Yeah.
Mu over t is constant.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. So, I mean, I guess this idea, I mean, certainly people from a long time ago have calculated something called, the quark number susceptibility, which is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to chemical potential. So a long time ago, Gottlieb and company did that. Recently, this has been taken up again by Gavai and Gupta, who've been sort of refining this calculation. QCD Taro have done some interesting work with finding the dependence of hadronic screening lengths on chemical potential but on both sides of the phase transition. Another approach that can be used is to actually perform simulations with imaginary chemical potential, which in that case, if mu is imaginary, it's just like a zeroth component of a gauge, an ordinary gauge potential. So the simulation works fine. And then one can presumably parameterize the resulting behavior one gets with imaginary mu, and then analytically continue back to real mu. And this approach has been pursued by Hart, Leiner, Philipson, and most recently, as Uwe showed us, by de Fourcron and Philipson, and their results. I haven't checked them, but they look quite similar to the results I'm going to show you now. So in a sense, what we've done is kind of a hybrid of those two approaches, in that we do reweighting, but we, instead of calculating the reweighting factor, this ratio of determinants exactly, we Taylor expand it and just estimate it to the first couple of orders. So the Taylor expansion of the ratio of determinants can be expressed actually as a bunch of traces with a fermion loop with the insertion of operators. So at the first order, I simply inserted dm by d mu, where m is the fermion matrix. The second order term will have a double derivative and two single derivatives, and so on. Now, the point about these diagrams is that actually they're reasonably straightforward to estimate in a lattice simulation. One uses a technique called a stochastic estimator, which means that you can which is very useful for any trace, any closed fermion bubble. The stochastic estimator technique will give you its value averaged over the whole lattice. So therefore, technically at least, this is much, much simpler than trying to estimate the value of this determinant. And for that reason, it's quite easy to go to larger volumes.
The expansion parameter is written there as if it's mu.
Yeah.
But it's really mu over T.
It's really mu A, which is really mu over T. Yeah. Yeah. In our paper, Fritzschoff made us be very careful to distinguish between physical mu and the lattice parameter mu, which is mu, always appears as mu times A. But I've been less careful in this on these transparencies. A is always one, of course. Like H bar and C.
A go to zero.
Not in this simulation. One thing which we occurred to us, and which we still haven't really settled, I'm going to sort of cover this at the end, is the fact that when one is estimating these diagrams, one's somehow estimating their average over the whole volume. You might expect that even if they fluctuate strongly, they might self-average as one goes to the thermodynamic limit. So in my mind, at least, there is a possibility that although these things will fluctuate in phase, their phase fluctuations might actually be alleviated as you go towards larger and larger volumes. And so it's not clear, at least to me, that we're going to have the same problems with taking the thermodynamic limit as an exact reweighting technique, but that's an open issue. How do the phase fluctuations cropping in? It's actually not very difficult to show that all the terms which are coming in with an odd power of mu are pure imaginary, whereas all the terms coming in with an even power of mu in this expansion are explicitly real. So therefore, if I show you how we implement those things, in principle, we can take an operator that we're interested in, we can expand both the operator as a Taylor expansion in mu, and we can also expand the determinant ratio in powers of mu and exponentiate it, and then use the exponential of that as a reweighting factor to perform a standard reweighting. So in a sense, we're doing halfway between Taylor expansion and reweighting.
Can I still ask about the previous transparency?
Sure, of course.
Long dead.
Yes.
So log depth is trace.
Trace log.
Trace log n.
Yes. So the, these are all traces.
Derivative of trace log. You get the first derivative of d and d mu in that case. So is this somehow quite automatic when you shift down to the paper and calculate this expression?
Yes, it's very ordered. It just becomes a common attack problem in how you distribute these things around the loop. Yes, I had written down the formulae. I mean, they're all in the paper. I just thought it was prettier to...
You mentioned complicated matrix and now it's a crucial point of simplification.
Oh, the point is that dmd mu is a local bilinear, as is d2md mu squared. All of these insertions are local bilinears. Of course, for each propagator, you have to do a matrix inversion. So this term is twice as expensive as this term to calculate because it needs two inversions. And then this term here, it needs three inversions, so it's three times as it.
So n is now a matrix on what size in your case?
Well, we're on a 16 cubed by 4 system.
So 16 cubed times 4 matrix. This is
the diagram you work out to evaluate the chiral condensate. So this diagram is exactly twice as hard to calculate it, twice as many operations. This diagram is three times as many operations. But it's... These are the corrections of the chiral condensate, so they would be none. Well, we're calculating them in the presence of a mass, anyway. But you expect chiral symmetry to be. Yeah. Yeah. So in principle, if I'm thinking about the chiral condensate, that's a real observable because it's a derivative of a real free energy with respect to a real parameter. And therefore, because of this fact that the odd order derivatives are pure imaginary, we actually expect that the first non-vanishing correction will be order mu squared, and it would have its corrections to that at order mu to the fourth. But when we estimate, say, suppose I let O be this fermion chiral condensate operator here, there will also be contributions to its expectation value which come from sort of cross correlations between the imaginary part of the expansion of the operator and the imaginary part of the reweighting factor.
Wait, let me understand this. So R1 and R2 are things that you calculate from a mu equals zero lattice simulation.
All of these things are calculated in mu equals zero lattice simulation. R1 and R2 are the Taylor expansion coefficients of the determinant ratio. No.
Each of those diagrams on the previous transparency represents a lattice calculation.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Sorry.
That was part of my question also. That the line is not the quad propagator you can do on the paper. It is in the background field.
Yeah.
So you should dress these with arbitrary gluon configurations and vacuum polarization corrections and so on. Sorry, yeah, I realize that, I mean, a lot of these things are kind of obvious to a lattice person, but they won't be obvious to real people.
We'll slow you down.
Please do. Yeah. So the effect of any phase fluctuations in the measure actually will, in principle, be folded into this calculation through cross correlations between this term and this term.
So is the thing at the bottom still exponentially small? In the volume?
I don't know. Not in the simulations that we've done. I'm going to discuss this right at the end. It's one of the things that, for me, it's an open question. But notice that, in principle, as well as reweighting from zero chemical potential to non-zero chemical potential, I've also, in this formula, allowed myself to reweight in temperature or coupling. And, in fact, in the simulations I'm going to show you, we get results as a continuous function of beta. And we actually do that by performing simulations at half a dozen values of beta and then reweighting between them. Now, one comment I want to make, I'm going to come back to at the end, is the chemical potential we're talking about here treats up quarks and down quarks equally, so it's an isosinglet or chemical potential. It's related to the just baryon number. I could also introduce a chemical potential which coupled with opposite signs to up and down quarks. This is what's often called an isovector chemical potential. This has the nice property that the functional measure is manifestly real, simply because if the up and the down quarks are given the same mass, then these two things are complex conjugates of each other in the presence of an isovector chemical potential. And what that means in terms of our expansion is that all these odd terms are actually manifestly zero. So another way of trying to gauge or trying to assess the impact of the imaginary terms is by comparing the results for an isosinglet chemical potential, quark number chemical potential, with an isovector chemical potential.
Returning to the question of Krishna, probably the exponent is still proportional to volume, but you take away term proportional to mu and mu squared out of the expansion. So presumably the coefficient starts from mu cubed or something like this. So it's better convergent than the previous one, but it's probably still exponential in that sense too.
Ultimately, if we're reweighting, it has to be. One possibility is that this is the formula we've actually implemented. It's technically the simplest way to do the calculation. But one could, in principle, also expand these exponentials and do a pure Taylor expansion, and then you could even Taylor expand the denominator and put it in the numerator. That's taking the Taylor expansion seriously. And in doing that, I think some of these imaginary terms will simply cancel. So it may well be that that simulation becomes less noisy. We just haven't pushed the method far enough to know. I mean, that's one of the things I'm going to come back to at the end.
So as soon as these two terms are enough, they're probably completely enough.
Okay. So now some technical details on the simulation. This is really for aficionados of lattice simulations, but we're using two flavors of P4 improved staggered fermions coupled via fat links to Szymanczyk improved gluons. And this is exactly the same technology that brought you those beautiful equation of state figures that we saw so much of last week. We're also using the same system size, 16 cubed times 4. What this means is that our ultraviolet cutoff is 4 times the temperature of whatever particular value of the coupling we ran at. So you can see this is still quite a coarse lattice. The cutoff's what, 600 or 700 MeV?
This is the size of the lattice for Kirchhoff's pressure.
Yeah. So this is a kind of technical point. The point of using these P4 improved formulation is that they give you not a bad match in the free field limit with Stefan Boltzmann value of the pressure. It's about 0.6. Where this should be 1. And similarly, the interaction measure is 1.3, where it should be 0. In fact, both of these numbers get markedly better if you could go to n tau equals 6. So the scaling properties of this action should be much closer to the expectation, sort of people's expectations, if one could do the next simulation up, which would be n tau equals 6. So in a sense, n tau equals 4, everything is a little bit preliminary.
What are fat links?
This is something very popular with people who do staggered fermion simulations. The big problem with staggered fermions, everybody knows that they're supposed to describe 4 flavors of fermion, but actually you want 2. So what you can actually do in the simulation code is arrange to take the square root of the determinant to go from 4 flavors to 2 flavors. Now that is a safe and kosher operation if those 4 flavors were all identical. But actually there are terms in the staggered action which violate that, what would it be, SU4 cross SU4 symmetry, and break it with terms of order the lattice spacing down to U1 cross U1. So in other words, you only truly recover the symmetry between the four flavors, which make it safe to take the square root, deep in the continuum limit, which is clearly where we are not in this simulation. Now, fat links is a way that people have proposed to somehow alleviate this flavor symmetry violation. And the idea is that so your basic coupling between quark and anti-quark would contain a link variable like that, and the fat links also contain the staple paths coming in with some numerical coefficient, and then you can show, and I think it's
just part of the fermions.
Yeah. And so the effect of having these gluons coupling as well as these gluons actually somehow they do something to the species doubling.
It's all the staples, right? The gluons coming out of them.
Yeah. The idea is it's supposed to make the theory more flavor symmetric, and hence you've got better control over the number of pions when you take the square root of the determinant, which you have to do.
I'm not sure.
Fuzzy, okay. Right. How do we introduce, I mean, this is once again a technical thing. We introduce the chemical potential by actually weighting the forward going temporal links by e to the plus mu and the backward one by e to the minus mu. This is actually the standard prescription, but as people have pointed out to me already, what this actually means is that because the thing that you're exponentiating is mu times a, what this means actually is it's the ratio of mu over t, which is constant as the gauge coupling is varied. And similarly, we've studied two different quark masses for staggered fermions, which once again physically corresponds to constant m divided by t. In fact, the quark masses we've studied, 0.1 and 0.2, the 0.2 is comparable with the strange quark mass, and 0.1 is considerably more massive than realistic up and down quark masses. So we're still, in this calculation, not near realistic quark masses. Simulations were done in Swansea. This is a back of the envelope calculation, don't I? Think.
10 to the 17th.
Yeah. That's a lot of monkeys.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing I want to show you is, you know, you might ask, is this reweighting working? One way of convincing yourself it's making sense is actually to use the same technology, but not to reweight in chemical potential, but to reweight in quark mass. So for instance, on these curves, this is the basic data that the simulation spits out. The black curve represents the susceptibility of one of our observables. That is, the susceptibility is another way of saying its fluctuations, parameterizes its fluctuations as a function of beta. And because we've done this reweighting, the data comes out as a smooth curve with some error band. The colored curves then come from reweighting in mass. So for instance, the black curve corresponds to the answer you get if the quark mass is 0.2. But suppose I make a small change to the quark mass, and I say, what happens if I make the quark mass 0.01 lighter? You can then reweight using the formula I showed you and generate this curve, which shows this is the susceptibility of the Polyakov line. It shows it moving to the right, to higher temperatures. It's peaking at a higher temperature, and also growing slightly. In fact, as I increase the mass still more, it peaks further on. So what you can see is that the position of the peak, which of course is, you know, the best knowledge we have about the location of the transition, actually is shifting as a function of quark mass. And also the height of the peak is increasing. In fact, this is interesting. This is the Polyakov line susceptibility. Now, the Polyakov line only becomes a true order parameter in the limit where quarks are infinitely massive. And actually, that's kind of shadowed here by this behavior. The peak and the susceptibility is becoming more singular as the quark mass is being increased. We have contrasting behavior if I look at the chiral susceptibility here. So once again, the black curve is the sort of basic simulation data, and then the colored curves are what I get from the reweighting calculation. And in this case, the singular behavior is growing as I go to smaller quark mass. And of course, it's in the limit of zero quark mass that the chiral condensate becomes an exact order parameter for the transition. So at least qualitatively, we appear to be getting plausible behavior from reweighting. And in fact, if you identify the position of the peak of the surductivity as the estimate for the critical beta, then the critical beta we get from these simulations looks consistent with what's known.
Could you reweight all the way down to a mass of 0.1 and then compare to the actual simulation at a mass of 0.1?
What we've done is we've reweighted. We've sort of looked at, we can look at the slope of the line between 0.22 and 0.18, and it kind of points quite close to the mass of 0.1. So we get the first derivative of the curve in the mass plane quite well. The second derivative not quite so well, but it looks plausible. That diagram's in the paper, but I haven't chosen to present it. Okay. So now I'm going to show what happens if you reweight in chemical potential. Okay. Yeah, sure.
I mean, this question is going to be more important with you, but does the method tell you when it's breaking down? I mean, when you were reweighting in mass, did the results just in the previous transparency? You didn't reweight all the way down to 0.1, but if suppose you had tried, does the method tell you when it's breaking down?
Yes, the error bars, eventually the overlap of your ensemble with the ensemble, the true ensemble that you would have, gets small, and so what happens if you try and reweight too far is that the error bars, if you calculate them properly, start to get large.
And you see that in the calculation of the error bars. I'm not asking you to calculate the error bars, but you would actually see that.
Because reweighting ultimately means the one configuration takes over all the rest or something like that. There would be terrible noise.
Yeah, you're focusing on the real configuration.
Right. Mm.
So this is the reweighting curve in chemical potential. What I've done on this plot is I'm first of all looking at the susceptibility of the chiral condensate. The black curve, once again, is from a zero chemical potential calculation, and the peak then corresponds to the critical value of beta at zero chemical potential. As you turn on a chemical potential, the reweighted data actually peaks, the position of the peak moves to the left, to smaller beta, which corresponds to smaller temperature. So therefore, if you believe that plot, it tells you that the critical temperature with none vanishing mu is less than the critical temperature at zero mu, which, as Misha told me last week, is consistent with the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. So that's a good job. In fact, if you just take the location of the peak, you can see the going from black to magenta to red is equal increments in mu, but actually the jump in peak position is quadratic. So I go a little way out to the pink and then quite a long way out to the red. So what one can do, I mean, here we've just chosen to plot three values of mu, but of course, because we actually have the derivative information, we can calculate the position of the peak as a continuous function of mu. And from that, we expect it to be a quadratic variation, and we can then fit it to a parabola. And that's going to be where our critical line will come from. Jeff?
Can you just remind me of something that you have with lattice? How do you map data to a value of the temperature?
Well, you have to. There's one parameter mapping between beta and A, the physical lattice spacing. So therefore, if you perform in principle, the lattice spacing also depends on all the parameters. It also depends on quark mass M and on chemical potential, in fact, as we were discussing this morning. But just for simplicity, just suppose A is a single-valued function of beta. Then you have to calibrate the lattice by performing a zero temperature simulation and calculating your favorite hadron mass or string tension or something, and put that into physical units. And that will then tell you what A is at a given beta. And once you know what A is, then you know what 1 over 4A is, and that's the temperature.
Can I give a simpler answer?
Yes, please.
So beta is 1 over G squared, and QCD is asymptotically free, which means that smaller G corresponds to smaller lattice spacing. So larger beta corresponds to smaller lattice spacing.
Yeah.
And the lattice is 4 lattice spacings thick, which means that as you go to larger beta, 4 lattice spacings becomes a smaller physical distance. And that distance is the inverse of the temperature, so it becomes a larger physical temperature. That's the logic.
Yes.
He just told it to you quantitatively, with 4 and whatnot.
Thank you. No, that.
So it all comes from the fact that it's asymptotically free, which tells you a relation between G squared and the lattice spacing.
I spend far too much of my time talking to other lattice people, that's plain.
B plus 1 over G squared.
Right.
So the normalization group says that we get E to minus 1 over G squared, which is E to minus beta. So not one loop temperature is related to E to minus beta. If you work at least one loop, you're going to be
okay. As far as we're concerned, this is a temperature scale. And this is low temperature, this is high temperature.
On this equation, there was a paper by Flippy some time ago.
Well, this equation?
That was not used.
Okay.
The paper of Clausius and Clausius.
Those guys have a... They're both increasing as you go from the hadronic phase to the quark. Actually, it's slightly more interesting than that, because this is something else Misha told me, which no doubt Clausius knew, is that it means that the slope of the phase, any phase transition line which comes in here, has to come in at 90 degrees, because entropy is exactly zero at zero temperature. But it also, because baryon number is exactly zero here, it also means that any phase transition line has to come in at 90 degrees.
Yeah, but we need to go upwards.
It could, in principle, do that. Yes, yes. It's not forbidden by thermodynamics. But from what
we just know, that in this case they are both positive.
Yeah. It's quite interesting to look at the Polyakov line and its associated susceptibility when you do this reweighting, because actually I cheated somehow. The Polyakov line is actually a complex variable, and that means it has different responses to positive and negative chemical potential. So you can reweight both in the red and go to positive chemical potential, which corresponds to having the Polyakov line in the presence of some background quarks, which are triplet charges, or you can have them, you can reweight to the blue curves, which corresponds to a background density of antiquarks. And it turns out what you can see immediately is that the antiquarks are much better at screening a Polyakov line, a triplet Polyakov line, than the quarks. And that's obviously quite reasonable, because you can form a gauge singlet from a Polyakov line and an antiquark. So therefore, there's a much bigger change going from the black line to the blue lines than there is going from the black line to the pink and red lines. And if you look at the susceptibilities, what you can see is that you can still see the peak of the susceptibility shifting to smaller temperatures, but also the singularity is much weaker when you have a background density of antiquarks, because they are screening the Polyakov line. So it's quite, I mean, once again, this is kind of reassuring that somehow this reweighting is getting capturing some of the physics of a background charge density. So although there's a kind of a linear component here to the behavior of the actual peak position, if you notice, is the same for both the red and the blue family of curves. So the shift is the same. The shift is order mu squared, and it's the same for both positive and negative chemical potentials, as it has to be because of this argument. But the actual physics of quarks and anti-quark screening is very different. This is an effect which you wouldn't see in two-color QCD because they're quarks and anti-quarks in the same gauge multiplet. Well, they're the same gauge charge. Okay. So as I said, what one can do from looking at the way these peak positions move is that you can fit the peak position as a quadratic function of mu and therefore make an estimate for this derivative, d2 beta critical by d mu squared, and that gives you a critical line. And what we found is that the value we get is about -1 with about 30 to 40% error, and it appears within those rather large errors to be the same for the two quark masses that we've investigated. So there doesn't seem to be a big variation with mass insofar as we've looked.
What the two mus which you showed on the last couple of transparent,
yeah,
your magenta,
yeah,
curves.
There was nothing special about them. They would.
But what mus on this scale? What mus did those two correspond to?
Oh, gold.
Roughly. Are they up near where it says Rick, or are they way out?
They're near where it says Rick. Very near where it says Rick.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd have to do a calc. I'd have to sit down and.
That's fine. This is a big extrapolation.
You obviously shouldn't take this figure too seriously, but it's the one we made.
Right. It must be in the region where you can't see these error bars.
I'm going to show you some more figures in the next transparency, so hold back on the figures. Let me just say, you've got the beta and mu are both lattice parameters. They're both essentially, you know, Fortran variables in a program. We have to convert those to physical units, and there are some formulas to do that. So, for instance, the physical variation of the critical temperature with respect to what's now the physical quark chemical potential is related to this lattice number via this formula, where this thing here explicitly depends on the way that the coupling constant depends on the cutoff, or the cutoff depends on the coupling constant, in other words, the beta function. And in fact, we have to get this from another calculation which Fritjof's done in an earlier life. And for the parameters we have here, it all fits. And the result for the physical curvature of the line comes out to be this. This I've quoted now the m equals 0.1 number. You see that the error is reasonably large. It's -0.14.
And this is what then leads to the blue band.
This is what leads to the blue band. Now you can ask, well, where should I be if I'm interested in Rick physics? And in that case, of course, everybody last week was talking about the baryon chemical potential at Rick, which is 45 MeV. We're doing the quark chemical potential, so we should be at 15 MeV, but actually that corresponds more or less to a ratio of mu over T of about 0.1. And that's where we've drawn Rick on our figures. That's what we mean, mu over T of 0.1.
What is Rick year 2000?
Okay. So anyway, you can be reassured in that case that our first result is that this curvature is sufficiently small, but essentially Rick is working. It's almost an immeasurably small effect.
Yeah. So Rick really is on the vertical axis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me, if I have a question. This is the second phase diagram picture that you showed.
Yes.
The first one also marked the distance shift to the material field and the same.
Yes. This is, well, it's very roughly speaking, it's the third the mass of a proton. So your zeroth order estimate is that the transition separating the vacuum from nuclear matter is just the energy needed to add a further proton is to first order the mass of the proton. And we have to divide that by 3 because we're doing counting quarks, not baryons. Now, in principle, this onset actually, from that onset, you should subtract the binding energy per nucleon in nuclear matter, but that's a very small correction. It's of order 10 MeV. So very roughly speaking, if you could do a simulation along this axis, nothing should happen until you get to a values of mu, which would be a third of the proton mass. Yes. Well, the point is, if you take our curvature seriously, too seriously, and you try and extrapolate all the way to t equals zero, you're actually coming down to a point which is way beyond that threshold. what that means, obviously, is that you shouldn't trust our calculation. So maybe that means that there will be higher order derivatives coming into play, or non-analyticities, and of course that's quite reasonable because we believe there's a critical point on that line. Okay, it's perhaps more interesting to compare our line, first of all, with Fodor and Katz's line, which they have given it in quite a bit of detail. So our line is this red one, and you can see we agree with them pretty well, all the way down to about here, which is where they suddenly have a kink, and their endpoint lies a little bit off the line. But even at this point, our error bars are consistent. So it's kind of reassuring, I think, that...
Do they say in their paper what this kink is?
No.
Do you even comment on
it? I don't think they comment on their kink. But I would worry about their kink now, I think.
But you have no way to see it, right?
We can only see the parabola, but our parabola seems to agree with their pre-kink curve quite well. Yeah, that's true. We couldn't see it even if it were there. Yeah, of course. Yeah. The other curve I've drawn in a moment of overexcitement was put our curve next to chemical freeze-out compilation. And what this tells you is that there's quite a... As you go to larger chemical potentials, there's quite a region where one's in what one would be in the hadronic phase, but with strong rescattering in elastic collision effects.
So even at mu, it's 1 GeV, you are on the top curve. You are at 150 MeV.
We've had to rescale by a factor of 3.
Because that's what Fodor and Katz said, that's what
the analysts do. Yeah. But of course, whether this looks like a slight curvature or a big curvature is a big function of your vertical scale. The error bars look much better on this plot.
But it actually is, because I was going to object to your previous plot, because you've got a T and mu with different scalings. If you scale them like the same, then it really... It's a small curvature.
Yeah. Can you show that one with the big, where it looks like a big curvature with a big blue arrow? I want to see where it hits.
It's here.
And that's the quark of 700.
Yeah. 4 by 3,
it's enormous.
Yes.
It's an incredibly flat curve.
And that is, by the way, maybe it's not if you show the previous one. To say something. So that is why there is a run at CERN with 20 GeV. And that may put a point between SPS and AGS, and if that point is on the red curve, like above it, not here, but above. This dashed line doesn't mean much, it's just some guess. It could be that it follows the red line and then depart to completely different line. So there would be a corner. Right?
Would you like to put the critical point at that corner?
No. It's just the crossing of his outline with the phase. So this is thermodynamical line. Suppose Simon is completely right and this is a thermodynamical line of the phase transition. And then there is here you are, his out in hadronic phase. So there is a separate line going like this and then crossing somewhere, like where the red point is. So the experiment will study this region and he find the points here. Then it would be obvious there is this and this.
Yeah.
Sir? No, I really think there is nothing here which would be
This is a phase diagram, and it's supposed to be very horizontal from all estimates, and then there is a problem.
Why are you saying it should be, I mean, look, those points are way below the red line, so why should, if they run in between, should it lie above them?
Well, because it's a separate line. There is, on some other variables, you can see more clearly that it is like a crossing, like in Cape Cod.
Surely it can't be a bad thing to want to put points here and here.
I predict the point would be somewhere here, and that would be like this, and then this.
Critical. What you're saying is you're predicting that when the data from the 20 GB run at SPS is released at quark matter, the chemical free now will be at the point where Edward's finger was. All these data points are chemical free now.
Data on the transparency of chemical breakdown. Maybe it's not appropriate. But what it will tell you that there is a phase transition line, and then there is a completely different line which crosses, which is a chemical result, which has only phase, has nothing to do with phase transition. That's like they're just crossing the end of.
The red line is the phase.
Why should the gray line be continuous line?
Simon's red line is the phase transition from theory, not from experiment.
What is this phase out temperature? You can see a mu, it should be much lower than TC.
No, this is chemical freeze out.
Let's talk about chemical freeze.
Not thermal freeze out, it's a chemical
freeze. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have put any experimental points there. It's just got everybody worked up.
Yeah, but that's all it's confusing.
If all you have is the experimental points and no dash lines, then there's two ways of drawing the dashed lines. One way is the way that they've drawn here, which is one perfectly plausible guess given where the experimental points are. What Edward wants to do is draw a straight line through these two, and a straight line through these two, and an angle. Right?
There's no reason they belong to the
There's no physics in these dashed. There's no physics in these dashed lines. So Edward is just saying.
They're there to guide the eye.
So he's saying no physics.
No, actually, he's saying it's constant energy per particle, per baryon.
This is a fantasy that some call results. It's not given by this condition.
Yeah.
There is a phase transition line, and then there is a result. No, the point is reality. The curves is fantasy. So what's the physics in these two?
I'll tell you what Edward is saying. Let me translate Edward. So what Edward is saying is that I think anyone would agree that this is freezing out in the hadronic phase.
Right. There's a special condition for that.
You know, whatever this is, it's freeze out in the hadronic phase.
What do you think about mine?
50 MeV is freeze out in the hadronic phase. Okay. And let's say that this is also freeze out in the hadronic phase at AGO. What Edward is then saying is that suppose there was no phase transition, suppose we just had freeze out in the suppose we lived in the hadron gas, then as you kept going to higher collision energies, it would do something, who knows what. You know, that's what Edward meant by this straight line. And instead what happens is you run into the phase transition, and then there's no way, I think everyone agrees that chemical freeze out cannot be above the phase transition.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical freeze out can be, the highest that chemical freeze out can be is at TC.
Yeah, the red line's
enough
about.
It's below. Here's an example of where it's below. But it can't be above. And so Edward's conjecture, which we can try and get out of bet money on, is that,
he doesn't know about the red line.
There's data coming soon. There's data that's been taken. It's analyzed, and we're going to hear about it in July at 0.4. This is the CERN low energy run. And Edward's conjecture is it will not fall on Redlich's, this is Redlich's conjecture here.
Mm-hmm.
It will not fall on Redlich's conjecture, the black dashed line. It will instead fall here. And I will make another conjecture, which is that the error bars on the experimental points will not be enough to settle this question.
Well, that's the last run of the tenet. It will never be answered.
My time's up.
Well, you've been interrupted. I don't know how much more you want to do.
You
should go on to your panel.
Very quickly, we also have studied the equation of state along the critical line. I don't want to bore you too much with this calculation. It's fiddly, but I can run through the main thing. we can actually look at the it runs in three stages. You can look at the variation of pressure with chemical potential, its first two derivatives, and they're actually related to physical quantities. This is actually a Maxwell relation, which says that the relation of the first derivative of pressure with respect to chemical potential is the quark number density, and that vanishes on the axis. And the second derivative is therefore the first derivative of quark number density with respect to chemical potential, which is a quantity called the quark number susceptibility. This is what Gottlieb and Gavai and company have been measuring for a long time. So we can measure this is our measurement of the quark number susceptibility. It's actually as a function of beta. It's actually this red line. And in fact, what the values we're going to use are its value at the critical coupling and also its slope. Okay. So the value of the quark number susceptibility gives me the second derivative of pressure, the curvature of the pressure, and that translates into physical units into these things, which maybe don't mean very much to you, but once again, at the sort of RIC value of chemical potential, the deviation from the zero chemical potential result is of order a percent. One thing that's amusing, and I've no idea, presumably this is something which can be settled experimentally, we can also estimate the baryon number. Because this is the first derivative of the baryon number with respect to chemical potential, we can estimate the baryon density at RIC, and it turns out to be between 6 and 10% of nuclear matter density, although the number we get seems to be quite sensitive to the value of the quark mass, so I don't think these numbers are yet stable. We need to go to the much lighter quark masses before we understand that better. One can also look at how the energy density varies with respect to chemical potential. That turns out to be related, at least in the approximation where you ignore variation of the lattice spacing with m and with mu. That turns out to be related to the slope of the susceptibility with respect to beta. And that gives us this number of about 10, which once again translated means that the energy density at the RIC point is about 1%. It's about a 1% deviation. However, these are variations along lines of constant temperature. So it's not actually the same thing as following the variation of these energy and pressure along the phase transition line. So to get that, we have to go to the condition for the lines of constant pressure or energy density in the plane. That's given by this combination of factors. This is the object which we've just calculated, and these two terms are available from Fritjof's earlier equation of state calculation. So without sort of getting too far into it, one can then combine these equations for the curves of constant pressure or constant energy density together with our estimate for the critical line, and we can combine those two things together to actually get an estimate for the variation of pressure and energy density along the phase transition line. And unfortunately, all the quantities involved come with error bars, and of course, instead of adding up, they subtract. So it turns out the ones subtract, taking the difference of quantities, which means that the relative errors that you finally end up with are rather large. But what we have is that the pressure along the phase transition line in our approximation will vary quadratically with chemical potential, but the coefficient is almost indistinguishable from zero, and the energy density along the phase transition line is completely indistinguishable from zero. So to the accuracy with which we've been able to work, we've got no evidence for these quantities varying along the phase transition line. Okay, I want to finish by just returning to this issue of the sign problem, because I've kind of avoided talking about it. One thing we can do is we can estimate the size of the sign fluctuations, because we have an expression for the phase of the determinant here is actually given in terms of one of these diagrams, so it is proportional to chemical potential. And it's proportional to the imaginary part of this diagram, which is actually the same thing as the imaginary part of the baryon density. So therefore, we know that the overall phase, excitation value of the phase must vanish because baryon density is a real quantity. But I can look at the phase fluctuation, the fluctuations of this quantity, and that will tell me how important the sign problem is. And what people who work on in this field, what they do is they tend to quote something that they call an average sign, which is basically the excitation value of e to the I theta. If the reweighting program which I've outlined is going to be effective, this thing had better stay of order one. It mustn't get too small. And what our data look like is, there it is. So here's our average sign as a function of chemical potential. You see, actually, it is decaying away rather quickly as you increase chemical potential. Now, the point where we've been calculating numbers comparing to Rick, the average sign is close to 1. So clearly, at that point, the simulation's working well. But what this is telling is if we were to try and push the bare mu much beyond 0.07.1, we'd run into problems. The sign problem seems to get worse either as we decrease quark mass, go from the blue to the red, or go to smaller temperatures. Now, in mitigation, I've been trying to estimate all of these terms using a technique which is itself noisy. It has errors. I don't calculate this thing exactly on a given configuration. I estimate it. And in fact, I don't want to get too far into the technicalities of how we do that, but one way one could actually beat down on this problem is just by using spending more time in trying to reduce the fluctuations on each configuration. That means using what's called different numbers of noise vectors in the stochastic estimator. So that's something we could explore. However, one thing which I think really shows that we're not in a rage, we haven't really pushed this method as far as it needs to be pushed, is, I remember, if you remember when I was outlining it, we were talking about comparing isoscalar chemical potential, quark number chemical potential, with isovector chemical potential. Now here we have a physical expectation, because we know for the theory with variation of isovector chemical potential, what should happen as you increase isovector chemical potential is that the onset of matter occurs at a completely different physical scale as you go along the zero temperature axis. With isoscalar chemical potential, we know that something funny should happen round about the nucleon mass scale, or the nucleon mass scale divided by 3, as we've already discussed. If you have an isovector chemical potential, you should start to induce matter into the ground state at the pion mass scale, at which point you get a charged pion condensate, as first argued by Son and Stefanov. So therefore, if you were going to try and plot out these phase diagrams the way we've done it, by assuming they're parabolic and measuring the curvature up here, it's clear that if you were getting the physics right, the curvature for an isovector chemical potential should be much greater than the curvature for an isoscalar chemical potential. And actually, if you look at our data, it's a little bit embarrassing, because this is the critical beta as a function of mu squared now. So the curvature is the slope of this line, and we actually see a greater curvature for isoscalar than we do for isovector. That's a little bit depressing. In fact, the reason for that is simply that if you go back and calculate the pion mass using the zero temperature pion mass in our simulation, it's actually at the same scale as the nucleon. So we're not close enough to the chiral limit to have a serious separation of scales here. But clearly, I think an important and non-trivial test of this whole game would be to go into the chiral limit, separate these scales, and then redo this comparison.
The curvature of the one go.
Yeah, it should. And it's interesting then, because if you assume that the curve that I've shown you is correct, because everybody likes it, because it looks kind of physical in degrees of Fodor-Katz, what it means is as we increase the sign fluctuations, nothing should happen to the red curve, but the blue curve should plummet like that.
Do you have the blue curve for the two values of quark mass? You have two values.
Yeah, I've shown you the worst one, actually. This is the heavier. No, this is the lighter quark mass, and the errors are large. I mean, within the errors, they're indistinguishable.
So to make it go down, you really need to push the quark mass way down.
Yeah. But there is another example we know. I mean, a very similar theory to the theory with our isovector chemical potential is two-color QCD. And two-color QCD is a theory which we've done a lot of simulations in. And what happens in two-color QCD, this particular variable I've here is the fermion density. This is an old slide. What's happening is I'm increasing chemical potential, and baryon density is zero up to some scale mu here, which is half the pion mass, at which point it starts to take off and one goes into a superfluid phase. So this simulation with the red points runs fine. It doesn't have a sign problem. However, there is one particular variant of two-color QCD with staggered fermions which does have a sign problem. It corresponds to a single flavor of staggered lattice fermions in the adjoint representation, so it'd be a triplet. So you can show that this is an old story now, but it does have a sign problem, and we were stupid enough, this group, to actually try and confront the sign problem and do a direct simulation incorporating the sign problem. Now, the point there is that if you just have one flavor of adjoint fermions, then the superfluid condensate is forbidden by Pauli exclusion principle. You simply can't write it down. And lo and behold, when you do the simulation, the phase transition corresponding to this superfluid vanishes, and essentially nothing happens as you go across. So once again, this is an interesting example where somehow the effects of the sign, it's perhaps a little bit non-intuitive. If you don't take the sign problem into account, or you don't have the sign fluctuations, actually nothing. Having the sign fluctuations makes nothing happen. Leaving the sign fluctuations out makes something happen. So the effect of taking correct account of the determinant actually makes the physics more boring in a sense. So similarly, in this thing, having the sign fluctuating makes the curvature less dramatic. Allowing the sign not to fluctuate or ignoring the fluctuation should make the curvature much steeper. Okay. So.
Well, that's like with the Glasgow method. The Glasgow method got an early onset.
Yeah.
And it's something interesting on physical. It's something interesting happening too soon. So that would again be.
Yeah.
Neglecting the sign fluctuations, making some physical parameter curve too much.
But it also tells you the sign problem is nasty. And somehow, although we've got a nice result with this reweighting, I don't think we've fully confronted this issue yet. Okay, so this is my summary. On the face of it, it's great news. We're now doing Rick physics in a lattice simulation, and that's exciting. So the curvature we have and the information that we've been able to get on the equation of state and on the critical line is consistent with what's known. It doesn't seem to violate anyone's expectations. It also seems to, at this stage, doesn't seem to depend much on the quark mass. But there are some things I think we still don't really, at least I don't really understand. I don't understand what the interplay is between the average sign or the sign problem and the ratio of convergence of the Taylor expansion. In principle, my simulations are all rigorously done at mu equals zero, and I'm just trying to Taylor expand into the plane. So should I even care about the sign problem? I just don't think we understand that yet. I don't know whether we're sort of doing approximate reweighting. Could we conceivably beat Fodor and Katz, who are doing exact reweighting? Could our method work better because somehow these terms we're estimating self-average, and the fluctuations go away? Once again, that's something which I think needs further study. My own sort of opinion about it has fluctuated quite a bit over the course of the project so far. And then I think, the thing which I think is urgently needs addressing is what happens as we go closer to the chiral limit. And if we do simulations of lighter quarks, could we get any information at all about the location of a possible critical point along the line? So these are all things to think about. Okay, thanks.
Can I ask you about basically the first and the last of your green things here?
Okay.
So, I mean,
Pritchoff will answer the last one.
Well, the last one, I mean, given that you're starting at mu equals zero and analytically continuing or Taylor expanding, however you want to put it, how could you possibly ever say anything about the critical point? Aren't you limited to the crossover region?
My answer would be, in principle, you could always calculate arbitrarily high orders and then do some kind of PADE and see at what point all those different estimates would start to diverge, and that might give you some information.
Oh, so you might see it by seeing that your things were breaking down prematurely.
Yeah, but I mean that's if you have perfect data, and yeah. You know, we've used our 10 to the 17 operations have given us a number with a 40% error bar.
Right.
So I don't think one can be too optimistic at this stage.
Sorry, what would break down? What are you saying?
You estimate the radius of convergence of a series by just seeing.
You mean looking at high term?
Yeah, yes. Looking at high term.
Yeah, it's extremely sensitive to the coefficients.
What about three flavors?
Three flavors. We're doing it at the moment. I don't have it. I can't tell you anything other than that. Yes, of course. On the other hand, we always remain on a finite volume, so you would hope that, in principle, we retain analyticity.
The likely to see this endpoint in this expansion technique is, of course, to see how the... Now we have looked at the motion of beta critical as a function of mu.
Yeah.
We can also look at the motion of the endpoint of line of first order phase transitions as a function of mu.
By starting with a mu for the quark masses such that the phase transition is first order at the vertical axis and watching it move away. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean then you have this phase time.
So I mean there's a light switch right near you.
Which unusually draws in a rectangular way, but you have the strange quark here and the up and down here, then you have this corner of first order phase transition.
Okay.
And now when you draw this in the new plane, then this border here will span up a surface in this three-dimensional plane. And we can, for instance, look at the three-flavor theory or later on also at the full theory. And look at this endpoint here, and check how it moves with mu. So that can be done, for instance, by calculating Winder cumulants and check their mu dependence. So you get a curve.
But so like if you're starting with a value of quark mass such that at mu equals zero, you have a first order phase transition.
Yeah, you have some values here and some values here. And then you construct your Winder cumulants, which tell you where this endpoint is.
Yeah, and then you can push that away with a mu.
And then you push this away with the mu and this away with the mu, and that gives you new crossing points for the Winder cumulants. And that determines the endpoint at a different point. And then when you know where the physical quark mass is in this plane, then you move up and have a prediction for the endpoint.
The first thing here, is what you're saying. I mean, there's two things. I mean, you could go and do the, you just did the quadratic estimate, the quadratic coefficient. You could now go and do the quartic and the octic and so on in principle. But is what you're saying in that first question there is, so suppose you did that, you know, with kind of with more flux, with more and more flux.
Yeah.
At some point, the fact that the execution of the cos theta is getting small. At some point, that should come and bite you when you're not sure where and how.
Yes, I think that's it.
Yes, I'm confused about the expansion, in particular as you get towards the tri-critical point, and we expect that number of fluctuations to become strong, just like in the typical space. The number of fluctuations are basically hidden in the second derivative with respect to the chemical potential. The first derivative gives you the average value number, the second one is n squared, which is the expectation value n squared plus the fluctuation. Now, fluctuations get indulged in the tricritical form. So, what does it say about the convergence of the series near the point where you want it most? In some kind of
Well, I wouldn't expect that the series
the compressibility of the system is changing.
No, the critical point must give a bound to the radius of convergence of the series.
Yeah.
Something Brent's discovering, but you're asking what exactly you're thinking.
Whether it means that the coefficients just become noisier and noisier and more difficult to calculate, that's one possibility. I just don't think we've pushed it hard enough for these things to show up.
I thought that the whole program, the focus of the whole program is to find that point T E and mu E. Precisely at that point, the equations are going to be kind of known. So what's the radius of convergence of these expansions?
No, he's not calculating susceptibilities at that point. He's calculating susceptibilities at mu equals zero. And then continuing, and then using that Taylor expansion to continue.
Yeah, the Taylor expansion is bound to graph for very large equations as it gets closer and closer to that.
Well, what Fritschoff has just said is that that's not the way to find the critical point. The way to find the critical point is this analysis. I mean, if I understood what Fritschoff said, he said that, can we ever say anything about the critical point? Fritschoff's answer is no, we can't using Simon's talk, but we can by doing what Fritschoff described. Is that a correct
translation? Right, because you can find it without mu and then follow.
Right, I'm following.
It's the same logic as this further cuts idea that you find its position and then follow.
Yeah.
It's easier. All right.
By the way, this makes it very interesting for Fodor and Katz and you guys know this, but to try and do a simulation with values of the quark masses such that the critical point is very close to the axis. And then, you know, see how things break down.
Well, okay, no, then let me ask the following question. Is there any evidence from this line of static that you have that there is a critical endpoint and it isn't all crossover?
No.
Point, let me ask for three flavors where I know I have a first order transition for light enough quark flavor, maybe it becomes first order, and then I get a critical endpoint. I mean, all you see is this line tracking.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, from your methods, no evidence of anything happening.
Right. Right.
No, in a sense, you know, we just assume it's a parabola and try and fit it. I mean, we can't say anything without calculating the next order, at least.
The only people who have evidence for their critical point from a lattice calculation are Bohr.
Yeah.
And then what you get, what's this kink? I never know this kink.
It's from their paper.
The mysterious. Fodor on Katz kink. I mean, it's just kind of curious that we follow them really well for a while.
Yeah, your red curve really highlights their kink, which I hadn't noticed before you pointed it out.
No, that's right. But our error bars are still overlapping.
Yeah, the slightly different critical temperature at zero.
Oh, yeah.
So the position of points themselves would rather suggest that something happened at 500 rather than 700, right?
If I don't look at the books,
right.
I would say something happened at 500.
I mean, to be fair, I think from the discussions I've had with Fodor, he would expect the position of the endpoint to move considerably as you change the volume and the quark mass.
Yeah.
He doesn't present this as his last word by any means.
And returning to what, so this point at mu equals zero, the point, the quark masses for which the point is at mu equals zero, that is not yet found either, right?
No. Only on the degenerate line.
On this line of
right.
Norms.
There should be tea and coffee happening out there, so maybe we should have thanks, Simon. Not today.
The physics school.
Tea and coffee is at the physics department because there's a physics club at 4 o'clock, which is over in the department. So, but anyway, let's thank Simon.